Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
No, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Sorry, howdy. My name is Woody, and this is Andy's room. That's all I wanted to say. And also, there has been a bit of a mix-up. This is my spot, see? The bed here.
Local law enforcement. It's about time you got here. I'm Buzz Lightyear, Space Ranger, Universe Protection Unit. My ship has crashed.
It was 1995 when we were first introduced to Buzz, Woody, and the gang, and to Pixar Studios. Since then, Pixar has created some of the most popular, inventive, and acclaimed animated features of the last couple of decades, along with countless memorable characters.
This week on the show, we'll devote some time to those characters with our top five Pixar performances, plus a review of Pixar's latest, Incredibles 2, which is out this weekend. All that and more.
You are a toy!
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Welcome to Film Spotting. This week, we transition from Aerosmith to animation. Coming off 2 weeks of classic rock talk with writer and critic Stephen Hayden, we shared our top five classic rock moments in movies, and we did have a Sacred Cow review of Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous.
I think we still have probably 40 minutes more of conversation somewhere Sam has.
Somewhere.
On file.
Yeah.
That was a long one.
The unreleased album that will come out long after we're gone, right? From the archives.
Exactly.
This week, we're talking Pixar. We've got a review of the new Incredibles 2, and later in the show, we will share our top five Pixar performances. And we do mean performances versus characters here. I think
correct.
We would both certainly have different lists if we were just focusing on our favorite characters versus
for sure.
What makes the performances themselves memorable. We will get into that and much more later. We'll also play Massacre Theater, where you will have a chance to win a Film Spotting t-shirt just like the one Josh is actually wearing right now.
Yeah,
sitting
too
across
much.
Me. Was it laundry
too
day?
Too much to wear it to the recording.
I love it. You're a fan. And podcast listeners will hear Josh's take on a few new releases, including the much buzzed about horror film Hereditary.
It's very comfortable. First, though, even sequel skeptics had to smile at the news that Brad Bird was revisiting his 2004 smash with Incredibles 2. Is the result a Cars crash or something closer to Toy Story territory?
So, are we going to talk about it?
What?
The elephant in the room.
What elephant?
Mom's new job.
It's time to make some wrong things right. Help me bring supers back into the sunlight. We need to change people's perceptions about superheroes, and Elastigirl is our best play.
Better than me?
Adam, we may have used our top five too real parenting moments too soon. We both liked Tully, which we reviewed on episode 680, and Tully was a good match for that top five. But man, would Incredibles 2, appropriately opening on Father's Day weekend, had been a nice fit as well. In Brad Bird's follow-up to his own 2004 film, a good chunk is devoted to the attempts of Mr. Incredible, once again voiced by Craig T. Nelson, to keep things running at Hearth and Home, while his wife Elastigirl, Holly Hunter also returning, is off on a superhero mission. Faced with his son Dash's math homework, his middle schooler Violet's romantic woes, and toddler Jack-Jack's, well, Jack-Jack has a number of issues, Mr. Incredible discovers that single parenting is even more of a challenge than saving the city from Underminer, the surprise villain at the end of The Incredibles who does return here. I'll just say right off that these domestic scenes were by far my favorite ones, partly because there are moments that, save for the superpowers, could have been pulled from my own experience. How about you? Did you need any of the superhero adventure stuff in Incredibles 2, or could you have just watched Mr. Incredible play Mr. Mom for an entire movie?
Well, I did need the superhero stuff, I think only because some of those moments, and we will get to those between this movie and the first one, are where I think these films actually really do soar. But I think that only happens because they are juxtaposed with these scenes of domesticity, and we're finally getting a chance to see them spread their wings, so to speak. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, you can relate to a lot of this movie, all of those scenes with Bob Parr home with the kids. And beyond just the day-to-day kind of grind of handling the emotions of the daughter and trying to make things right there, and also trying to keep the baby from destroying everything, and taking care of the son, making sure that his math homework is done properly, and all that exhaustion. I think the moment actually that I most related to was even before we got to that stuff, and it's that bedtime conversation with Holly Hunter, with his wife, Elastigirl, where she's the one that's going to go away, and he does sacrifice, I suppose. The sacrifice she's been making this whole time, he recognizes that as much as his own ego needs that boost, and as much as he is used to being the quote-unquote provider and being out there, he has to be okay with not being that person anymore and genuinely being supportive of his wife when he really hasn't had to be, at least that emotionally. He hasn't had to actually be that available, and here he has to be available.
Yeah, it's the fact that he has to do more than just play nice at her being part of this superhero life that he leads.
Right.
You know, he didn't seem to mind having her be a part of it until it started to overshadow him. And then it's an entirely different story.
Yep.
And they have a late night talk. That is a great scene, just like the late night talk in The Incredibles is a highlight from that movie, that is at once about these fantastic things going on in their lives that no one could relate to, but under the surface are the same arguments we've all had to one degree
Absolutely.
Or another, right? So that's why it works. And for a little context, we should probably say that the reason Elastigirl has been recruited is the story arc here. There's a brother and sister owner of a tech corporation, mm-hmm. you get the impression, who want to launch this campaign to bring superheroes back into the limelight, make them legal again. And they've decided that Elastigirl is better to be the face of that campaign than Mr. Incredible. It kind of ties into some of the Avengers conversations
sure.
that we've been having over a number of years, that he just leaves this, you know, destruction in his wake, and Elastigirl is a little tidier in doing justice. So they like that aspect of her. And yeah, of course you want to see those scenes. I think primarily because that's where some of the action really takes off, and we can see Bird, the action filmmaker, at work when Elastigirl is pursuing these various villains. But another favorite moment of mine does go back to those domestic scenes, and that's Bob's breakdown.
Yeah.
Because at this point, it's not just a situation where he's set up to be the fool
right.
and to be deflated. It starts there, and you get some humor from that. But then he really digs in, right? And he's doing his best as much as he knows how, and he still can't make
right.
it. And he gets to a breakdown scene. And I think what's nice about that, what I like about Incredibles 2 is how it does give so many more moments to the kids as well.
Mm-hmm.
Violet, Sarah Vowell,
yeah.
man, spoiler, she didn't make my top five, but really gave her a lot of consideration for The Incredibles. Maybe mm-hmm. it's just because she doesn't get as much time in that film as she does here.
Sure.
And she's fantastic
she
once
is.
Again. We really get to understand Violet's inner life, and even Dash, voiced by Huck Milner.
I love Dash.
He's
might
he's
actually
right
be my favorite
here.
Character
he really,
between these two films.
He gets a lot more to do in this film as well. And in that scene where Bob breaks down, they're included in it, and it's the reactions on their face to see their dad brought to this point.
Yes.
And to realize that, you know, it's not their fault, but some of the choices they've made have led to this.
Yes.
And they all kind of come together and realize that, okay, we've got to help him too because he needs it.
Yeah.
And it's really moving. And I think you could say that of The Incredibles as well. So Bird manages to once again capture that balance of exciting action film and moving domestic drama, domestic comedy
yep.
in many ways. I would say this is less of a Bond film and more of a superhero film than The Incredibles. And that for me might work a little bit against it. I was more interested in the Bond tropes in the first film
than what they do here. Because I was never more aware between these two films, and I just watched The Incredibles again yesterday for the first time in a long time. I was never more aware of the Giacchino score sounding so Bond-esque.
Yeah,
I really felt like I was watching a Bond film or a riff on a Bond film, and I know that's part of the time period that it's playing with and all that stuff, but for whatever reason, that was even more apparent this time. That breakdown scene too, I just want to mention, because it ties in with this top five, thinking about what makes a vocal performance stand out. Craig T. Nelson, fantastic as Mr. Incredible, but that scene,
I know,
the humor really does derive not only from everything that's gone into the setup and all the things you talked about and the kids, but it's also just the vocal performance, where his voice goes from the beginning of that scene to the end, the kind of range of that breakdown is magnificent.
It is. It really is.
Now, when we started talking about those superhero scenes or seeing those moments that are outside the realm of the household, what I realized rewatching The Incredibles is that what actually thrilled me the most, thrilled me being the right word here, the most about that film and what got me the most emotional, actually, at times. It really did happen like four times. I don't know what's going on with me these days, but that was the case over the last 20 or 30 minutes of the first film. It's the same element that thrilled me here. It's watching these characters get to do the things they were actually born to do. Watching them fully be themselves instead of repressing something that's fundamental to who they are. And look, I'm just going to throw this out here. I've been meaning to go back and read some of the think pieces and criticism of the first film and try to better understand all the Randian stuff. My knowledge of Ayn Rand covers basically Paul Ryan jokes and Rush lyrics. So I'm not the guy.
Never even read The Fountainhead?
Nope. And do not plan to be honest. But my favorite moment in Incredibles 1 is watching Dash when he starts running on the water.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that moment where he's been doing it for like 5-10 seconds. And then he looks down and actually acknowledges what his feet are doing and what he's pulling off and the absurdity of it. And he giggles about it.
Yeah.
I love that
himself moment.
Yeah. I love that moment of joy when he amazes himself. And that goes back to that other moment earlier too, on the island where he gets told by one of the parents that he has to run as fast as he can. I get to run as fast as I can. And this is awesome that he lets out at one point. The exuberance of that character generally, but especially when cutting loose. For me, and this really does match all the characters, they all get a moment like that. That for me is the exuberance at the core of this entire series. And I think we get a moment like that here too. We get many of them, but watching Elastigirl, when she finally gets to be the one, her first stakeout, she has that moment where she even acknowledges, I criticize my husband for being the one listening to the scanner, and now I'm the one doing it. But she gets to fully break out of that homemaker mode. She's completely on her own, and she really gets to realize the full extent of her abilities and all of her skills and talents and actually be excited about it, have fun doing it. When they're having fun, I'm having fun.
A new Elasticycle.
Elasticycle? I didn't know you had a bike.
Hey, I had a mohawk. There's a lot about me you don't know.
Yeah, but a mohawk?
You didn't miss anything. Oh, yeah. This one's electric.
What's that mean?
Whoa. Means it's torquey. I'll get the hang of it.
You will be great.
I will be great. And you will too.
We will both be great.
Bye, sweetie.
We saw glimpses of it in The Incredibles. I still think the scene with her getting caught in the series of doors is one of the great superhero action sequences of probably the last 15 years. But here, she gets numerous set pieces, and they're doing those two things. They're exactly doing what you're talking about, letting her live into her powers and also giving a chance for Bird and his animators to do whatever they can imagine. And I love the bike that she has this time, which actually splits in half so that she can stretch while remaining on it and do all different tricks and use her powers in ways that a normal bike might limit her from doing.
Right.
So that's a great touch. There's a really psychedelic showdown with one of the villains. It's in some sort of cage or box, and the lights start flickering. It's like a strobe light effect that is so disorienting.
It is.
In a good way, though.
Right.
It kind of jolts you out of
–
I wouldn't ever describe any of this film as cartoonish, but that brings us in sort of a different animated dimension all of a sudden.
Did you feel that it was shockingly violent too? It felt to me unlike any of the other sequences here. And I maybe just have to acknowledge, even though she's Elastigirl and I don't have to think of her as a woman versus the big burly man, she can more than take care of herself. Something about the brutality of the stick.
A weapon that's almost like sending electric shocks.
And she's in pain. We see her for the first time actually.
It's scary.
Actually feeling that pain. Yeah, it is scary.
Yeah, it's a scary sequence. And at the same time, another exciting action sequence. And so the movie has a number of those. I do wish, I will say this, as you're talking about her, you know, living into her powers, we see that. And I think those first scenes where she's thinking about how Bob used to do this and being reflective, that does tend to get lost along the way so that this journey for her is not the same sort of crisis of conscience as Mr. Incredible's journey was in the first film.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Where he has to come to realize that fatherhood is really what matters most to him.
Yeah.
And he very blatantly does that. You kind of think that's where this is going to go, and it doesn't.
It could go a number of different directions. It could, you know, be a consideration of what is it like for a woman who has been home to enter the workplace, and what are sort of the maybe there's an element of regret to it. Maybe there's, you know, there are all sorts of layers at play that I think The Incredibles gave to Mr. Incredible in that story arc that we don't quite get here. It's not, you know, nothing's like glaringly wrong about it. It's just when you hold the two in comparison, you see that there was some opportunity to go there for Elastigirl as well.
Yeah, maybe so. And in a way, though, I kind of like the fact that it didn't go for that easy kind of emotional arc of the mom who's finally getting to bust out and not be at home, and she has to feel any bit of guilt about it.
Yeah,
I like the fact that it doesn't
want
do that.
It to be any sort of shaming thing.
No.
I don't mean to say that, but it kind of gets dropped.
Yeah.
Like her inner experience of all this gets dropped in favor of saving the day.
Yeah, in favor of action.
And,
it does.
And yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. What did you make of the fact, or were you surprised by the fact that it literally picks up right where it left off, which almost never happens in sequels?
I was surprised by that. And, you know, I guess I'm okay
and
with
why
it.
Do you think? Have you given that any thought? Like, what would that possibly accomplish, I guess? Or
I guess it comes to – it's a larger question I was thinking about is
– we did just see the movie for the record.
Yeah, we just came
like,
out of the review.
Just came from it.
Is the story itself here – the strongest point of Incredibles 2? I have to think if you're the creators of something like The Incredibles or anyone involved in it, you'd really have to say, I'm going to do another one because I've got a great hook, a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the flipping of the roles in the home is strong. Obviously, we've responded to it well. But I don't know if it's that aha idea I thought they might have had when I heard there was going to be an Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
It's more of like, that makes sense. You'd go there. And it is kind of the next step.
Yeah. No, it did feel a little at first certainly uninspired to be like, this is what we've waited 14 years for. We're going to pick right up where it left off. And then also on top of it, even when we do finally meet the brother and sister team who kind of drive all the plot forward, that even felt to me kind of like Syndrome, or at least Buddy, early in that film, where you have kind of a super fan who is trying to bring the superheroes back, and then there's other things going on. So I felt like this is a little bit of a retread, but I suppose it did, in a way, underscore the fact that as much as things haven't changed, things have changed. And even more pointed than that, I guess, it seems to be a deliberate choice on some level, maybe, to do or not to do what Violet jokes about when she's talking to the boy that she likes, and she makes the joke about him seeing her in her tights, and she's part of a theater company that's doing Shakespeare, and they're trying to make it cool for the kids.
Yeah.
Almost like, we're not going to go for the easy cultural jokes by somehow jumping forward in time and it being about this kind of fish out of water thing where we now see the superheroes in a different element completely.
Yeah.
So they don't go for that, and I think for the most part that does work, but you also have among all these other messages that the movie seems to be kind of trying to deliver, various statements being made by this film, I'd say more so than what we got in the first movie. There's this contradiction where the villain is driven by this notion of technology ruining everyone's lives. It's destroying all of our connections and our interactions, and even more than that, we're putting all of our trust in these talking heads on TV. But this is like the 60s or something. And so you're going, wow, that feels like there's a disconnect. But in a way, I'm just thinking this through here. In a way, that does underscore for us as viewers watching this setting, watching these people and going, this is nothing like what we have today. Imagine if this villain saw how much we really were ensconced in technology every moment, how they'd freak out. Well, that's kind of the point.
Yeah, there is a weird villain speech in the middle of it that I'm having trouble putting in context
right.
with some of the other things that the movie seems to be saying. I would say in general, you mentioned Syndrome. There's a villain drop-off here for sure. At least there was for me. For one thing, there's a bit of mystery to it.
Yes.
That's kind of
like there
easy.
Was with Syndrome too. For
there
a while.
Was. Yeah. There was. It's easier to see through this mystery, though, I would say.
And oh, yes.
Pinpoint where things are going. And yeah, the motivation just, I mean, that was one of the great things about Jason Lee's Syndrome.
Yes.
Is perfect motivation there that you absolutely believed and understood.
Oh, yeah.
He was.
We'll have some more Syndrome talk.
Kind of like a Killmonger figure in a lot of ways, Syndrome was. And here, that element isn't as strong. So do you think the movie had too much Jack-Jack? Did it lean on Jack-Jack and you never knew what power is going to erupt when or the baby giggle? I mean, I was all for it for most of the running time. I think the showdown he has with the raccoon
is
absolutely
that's the best
brilliant.
Sequence. That's the funniest sequence in the movie.
It's so funny because the raccoon doesn't give up. I mean, this thing is really persistent and you get to see all Jack-Jack's powers there. But I did feel by the time the climax came around that they were leaning on that quite a bit. But
yeah.
Maybe I just don't like babies.
Apparently not. I didn't have that reaction as much, though I was scared because I saw somebody a couple nights ago tweet something about the movie's great and Jack-Jack steals the whole thing. And I'm like, great. So it's really going to be just scene after
all
scene of baby stuff. But maybe because I went in with that expectation, it didn't feel overwhelming to me.
And they might have been referring to the raccoon scene.
They might have been. But I loved that sequence so much. And I think just the fact that everything that does happen with Jack-Jack, it's just this sense of discovery for these parents. And so it does ultimately, in a way, tie back to the central couple and their family.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which is at the core of this story. I want to bring up at least one more larger message here, or whatever the movie might be trying to get at. And I think it probably does try to cram in too much. And ultimately, whatever those statements it's trying to make aren't the strength of the film, as we have said. But there was something for me to consider in the way the movie seemed to suggest that the truest superpower you could have in this environment. And again, this is a 1960s type setting that seems very quaint and a whole lot less evil day to day than the world we live in right now. They seem to suggest that the best superpower one can have is to actually have a lack of cynicism, to have a sense of hope at all. To be cheesy for a second, the name of the boat is Everjust.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually, in the face of all these things, all these atrocities that we're witnessing every day, to be that way is the most remarkable thing you could actually be. To live in today's world and feel that way and to actually behave that way truly requires superhuman abilities.
I think it ends up in that place for sure, but it starts somewhere that's even more provocative, I would say. One of those early conversations that I think Helen and Bob have before the late night one is
lawful.
What do you do?
Yes, unlawful.
What do you do if there is an unjust law? Do you obey it or do you fight to change it?
Yes.
And is that justice? Now that sounds pretty timely. It sort of gets dropped, you know, fairly quickly on Elastigirl becomes accepted and that she doesn't really have to sort of be this shadowy figure fighting against the law for justice.
No.
That's a thread, kind of a hook they drop.
It is.
And then don't really pick up again.
And I like that
understandably,
the hook is there.
It's interesting to think about. Understandably, maybe not the place in an animated family film. I was kind of excited when I saw it drop in at first and thought, ooh, this, let's see where this goes.
But yeah.
Still goes to some pretty fun places.
Incredibles 2. Is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We're going to try a little voice acting of our own when we come back and play a round of Massacre Theater. Then we'll return our attention to the pros with the Film Spotting Top 5, Pixar performances. Stay with us. Woke a dog from a running dream in this bad luck.
Engagement ring, that's bad luck. Bad. said it.
This is the most dangerous creature that ever walked the earth.
I say we shut this whole thing down.
If by shut this whole thing down you mean no more Jurassic Park movies, sure, that gets my vote, Jack.
Adam.
I'm such a hater right now.
You are. You need to – what I used to tell myself in my daily newspaper reviewing days, and I had to see everything that was released, anything can be great. Anything can be great, Adam.
I love your lack of cynicism, Josh.
That's right.
It really is inspiring. Chris Pratt there in the trailer for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Early word on this one seems not great. But that is not going to stop us because of Josh's optimism. Next week, we'll have a review of Fallen Kingdom. It comes to us from J.A. Bayona, who has made three prior films. One I love, The Orphanage. One I hate, The Impossible.
That I love.
And one I probably realistically will never bother to see, A Monster Calls.
Yeah, it's...
So it's the trifecta.
It's worth seeing. This, for me, is reason for hope.
And now, Jurassic Park, Fallen Kingdom, a movie I would never see except you and Sam are forcing me.
And when you love it, you'll be back on the Bayona bandwagon.
Oh, yeah. We can all sense it coming, can't we? Along with that review, we will have a top five TBD, though I haven't weighed in on this yet. I'll weigh in live on air.
Yes, I can't wait to hear this.
I think that a Chris's power ranking might actually be stupid fun.
Yeah.
And we should do it.
That's the idea. It's
so
time.
Is it a top four then, though? Pratt, Hemsworth, Evans, Pine?
No, I think...
We get to randomly pick another Chris?
Andy Mitchell or our production assistant, or maybe this was Sam's idea. Someone threw out there that we each get to pick a fifth Chris.
Great. Chris Walken. Walken's my number one.
Let's try to think of a contemporary, okay?
Okay.
Play along.
Yeah.
And maybe you need to bump this fifth Chris up.
We're going to decide this once and for all. No more joking, no more kind of goofy poll questions. We're deciding once and for all who the best Chris is.
Be watching 15 different Chris movies in preparation.
Oh, man. If you have any thoughts on that top five or, frankly, anything else, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. I should point out that you can also send us an audio file instead of leaving us a voicemail.
Did we even mention which Chris's we're talking about? Do we need
to? No, I threw them out there.
You did? Okay.
I think I got to Pratt, Hemsworth, Evans, Pine, not in that order or order to be decided. At filmspotting.net/events, that's the place you go if you live in the Chicago area for advanced screening and run of engagement passes. Now, I said Chicago area listeners. We actually have a little something over there for our Seattle area listeners, and I know there are many of you out there. We've got passes to the June 19th series premiere of HBO's Sharp Objects. It's based on the 2006 debut novel from Chicago author Gillian Flynn. Of course, she wrote Gone Girl. The miniseries stars Amy Adams. She's a reporter confronting her past when she returns to her hometown to cover a violent murder. Guess who also stars in the series and will be at this screening participating in a Q&A afterwards?
Could it be a Chris?
It could be a Chris. Chris Messina.
Ooh, a good Chris.
The very good Chris Messina.
We'll see if he makes... A potential number five.
There you go. We'll see if he makes one of our lists or both. The screening is at Seattle's SIFF Cinema Uptown. Again, that's Tuesday, June 19th at 7 p.m. We have free passes to give away to that. So Q&A with Chris Messina, one of the top five Chris's potentially, and you get to see the debut episode of Sharp Objects. And there's more. This time for our Chicago audience, we're partnering with HBO on these Q&As. Obviously, not only the Seattle one, but there's one in Chicago, too. It's coming up on Friday, July 13th. By the time everyone hears this, you will be able to go to filmspotting.net/events and see all the info you need, the location, the time, and how to enter to get those passes. Not only will I be moderating the Q&A, there's a really good chance Michael Phillips is going to join me on stage.
Very nice.
To also moderate it. You weren't available, so I had to go out and get a true pro, Michael Phillips.
Yes, probably for the best.
And Gillian Flynn.
Nice.
So come out, see one of the episodes of the series, hear that Q&A, and then there's a reception afterwards for everyone who attends. So it's kind of a film spotting meetup. You don't get to meet Josh. No, but
sorry,
you'll get to meet myself and Michael Phillips. Who doesn't want to participate in that? Filmspotting.net/events. And wait, there's more. There are more meetups.
More meetups.
You know, if you have nothing more you want from life than having us buy you a few drinks, we will bribe you for your
to be our
friendship
friends.
And loyalty. Josh, you have one coming up. We'll see if you have one coming up. Well,
one
or two.
I need to float this out there and see. For reasons I won't disclose, I have to leave the country in late June and early July.
Uh-huh.
So one of the spots I'll be is Oslo, Norway. And then after that, I'll be in Amsterdam. I would like to do a meetup at one of those places, but I don't know which one it might be worth it to do. I'm not going to be in either place very long. So just throwing it out there, if there are listeners right. in Oslo or Amsterdam, very end of June, early July, might be available, might be interested. Maybe send us a note. Find me on social media, Larson on Film, or send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Suggest a few places
yeah.
for good meetups in those cities, and we'll see if we can work something out.
So that sounds like a lot of fun. Absolutely. Email the show or contact Josh if you are interested. I've noted this before. The longest distance meetup that's ever happened in film spotting history was me in Helsinki, Finland.
I know.
I think it was 2008, maybe 2009. Four Finnish listeners showed up, bought me some vodka. It was fantastic.
And that kind of annoys me because if Helsinki was not further away than Oslo, I'd be putting a lot more effort into
yes.
Oslo.
Yes.
But since I can't break a record here,
nope.
what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. That was the furthest distance meetup. The first ever film spotting meetup took place. Do you have a guess?
In your backyard in Iowa?
At a pizza ranch. No.
Did it really?
No, no.
Oh.
It was in San Francisco, of all places.
Well, there you go.
In 2006, I want to say, I'm going to be returning to the scene of the crime. I'm going to be in San Francisco at the end of June. Don't you love how we're going to be on trips with our wives, and yet we're arranging film spotting meetups?
Well, that's another factor that has to be considered.
Yes. But I'm hoping to get together with more San Francisco listeners.
Actually, for me, as you know, Debbie was the problem at the London meetup.
I know.
She kept me out. She kept me up way too late. So I kind of don't want her to know there's
one. We all know she's way more fun than you.
This is true.
I'm not sure if we will have all the details about the meetup on the website by the time you hear this, depending on when you listen. But it's coming soon. June 24th is a Sunday night, I think. That's the date I'm targeting to have the meetup. Felt like Sunday night was probably the best night. I'm going to be there for, I think, three nights. So check filmspotting.net/events or just email the show feedback@filmspotting.net if you're in the area and would like more information about that. I do have one other quick tease I want to mention. A few weeks ago, I mentioned my conversation with Bo Burnham, and we're not going to be able to share that and talk about his movie Eighth Grade until it opens July 30th. Now I'm really going to tease folks. This one, you're not going to hear it until September 7th. When the movie he directed opens. But we landed one of the guests who I've been most eager to get over the past 2 or 3 years on the show. It finally happened. Talked to him just last week, Josh, Ethan Hawke.
What was your giddiness level?
It's all kind of a blur.
Yeah,
the whole conversation's kind of a blur. But
did this happen or was this a dream you had?
No, it really happened, I think. He even enjoyed it. At least he said so. And he seemed to be genuine, Josh. It wasn't just him being polite. It was a good chat. It was about 22 minutes. Would have liked to get in a full 30 with him. It didn't happen. I would have really liked to have more like 40 or 60. But we will save it for another time when Ethan Hawke comes on the show. He does have a movie coming out, Blaze, a biopic of sorts. And we start the conversation by talking about how it's really not a biopic at all, of a country artist named Blaze Foley, who I had never heard of, but was kind of the predecessor and inspiration in some ways to guys like Merle Haggard, Waylon Jennings, those kind of outlaw country music artist. It's a good film, and I was happy to talk with Ethan, so look forward to that in September. We move on now to Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a Film Spotting t-shirt. A couple weeks back, we massacred this.
Well, looks like you came a long way for nothing.
With all due respect, Sheriff Rollins, I'd like to recommend checkpoints on a 15-mile radius at I-57, I-24, and over here Route 13 east of Chester.
Whoa, wait a minute. The prisoners are all dead, and the only thing checkpoints are going to do is get a lot of good people frantic around here and flood my office with calls.
Well, Sheriff, I'd hate to see that happen, so I guess I'll take over your investigation.
On what authority?
Governor of the state of Illinois, the United States Marshal's Office, 5th District, Northern Illinois.
All right, fine. You want jurisdiction over this mess? You got it. Okay, boys, gather around here and listen up. We're shutting it down. Wyatt Earp's here to mop up.
That was Tommy Lee Jones, obviously, as Samuel Gerard, with Nick Searcy as Sheriff Rollins in 1993's The Fugitive. Fugitive was written by Jeb Stuart and David Twohy and directed by Andrew Davis.
You know, lots of people wrote in saying, you nailed Tommy Lee Jones. No one said I nailed Nick Searcy.
No.
No. I don't know why.
I think
tragic.
You did, people. You know, just don't know him as well.
That Massacre was part of episode 682. We reviewed Solo, A Star Wars Story, and we conducted a joint interview with the legendary screenwriter and director Paul Schrader, whose great new film is First Reform, starring Ethan Hawke. And now listeners provide the connections between that show and The Fugitive.
Here's Jesse from Rumford, Rhode Island. The obvious tie-in here is Harrison Ford playing both the titular fugitive and Han Solo, but there are also prominent train scenes in both The Fugitive and Solo.
Well
also,
done.
This might be a bit of a reach, but wasn't the bad guy in The Fugitive missing an arm? There seems to be a lot of that going on in the Star Wars universe.
Tom Robertson in Burwood, Victoria, Australia, says the current film spotting poll is about actors taking on iconic roles. And in Solo, the role Ford made famous is being played by Alden Ehrenreich. And while the poll focuses largely on the recasting of cinematic icons, Ford's Kimball in The Fugitive is a recasting of the iconic role from the TV series that The Fugitive is a remake of. Now, that one we intended, or at least our producer, Sam, intended it. That was one of the reasons why he picked the scene, is that recasting there. Well done, Tom.
Here's Ken Link from Flagstaff, Arizona. Along with The Fugitive's starring role being played by the original Han Solo, the film also features two actors, Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones, who have seen younger versions of themselves played on screen. Ford by Alden Ehrenreich in Solo, and Tommy Lee Jones by Josh Brolin in Men in Black 3.
Wow.
Which is Brolin's best role, a fact unrecognized by another recent film spotting poll. Wait a minute. Is this film spotting's attempt to gain momentum for a Fugitive prequel with Ehrenreich and Brolin in the lead roles?
I'd watch that.
Yeah?
I'd definitely watch that. Mike Cahotas in Gilberts, Illinois writes, The Fugitive also features Julianne Moore, who took over the iconic role of Clarice Starling in Hannibal, the sequel to Silence of the Lambs, where Clarice was played, of course, by Jodie Foster.
Look at you, Mike. Aaron Crabtree said a less apparent connection would be the great Fugitive DP, Michael Chapman, who also shot the Paul Schrader-scripted films Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and the Schrader-directed Hardcore.
Man. This is getting eerie. Devin, Jolly Jackboot Wombold in Long Island City, New York, closes us out. One last connection with Han Solo and The Fugitive's Richard Kimball. Nick Nolte was supposedly considered to play both characters before Ford ultimately took the roles. But no worries for Nolte. He got to be in Three Fugitives with Martin Short instead.
Wait a minute. Nick Nolte as Han Solo?
Ever since I read that comment, I've just been hearing Nick Nolte in my head going, "Ah, hell, Chewie."
I've never heard that before. Is that real?
Hell.
Is that true?
Devin says it's true.
All right.
Josh, reach into the brimming film spotting hat. Lots of love for The Fugitive, or maybe just your recognizable Tommy Lee Jones impression. More entries for this than really any Massacre Theater over the past year or so. You get to reach in and pick out the winner.
The winner is Ethan Johnson from Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
Congrats, Ethan. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
Wow, the rare dual funny voices edition of Massacre Theater coming up. And if there was any doubt about what part I was playing, what part you were playing, talk about a screenwriter providing too much in the way of on-screen direction.
Mm-hmm.
This actually says patented AK gasp. I didn't know I had one.
Oh,
now I feel a lot of pressure.
You do it. I can't wait to hear it. You've got to go. You got to go very breathy here.
Uh-huh.
Think Marilyn Monroe. This is not Marilyn Monroe.
You know who it is? It's not. It's Marilyn Monroe mixed with Tootie from Meet Me in St. Louis.
Oh.
Isn't that her name, Tootie?
Oh, you've got that down.
That's it.
Yeah,
I don't think I do.
You've got that in your back pocket.
But I'm
going
to try it. All right. I started off with my patented AK gasp.
And action.
All alone, my pet?
Why, yes, I am. But
the little men are not here?
No, they're not, but...
Making pies?
Yes. Gooseberry pie.
It's apple pies that make the men folk's mouths water. Pies made from apples like these.
Oh, they do look delicious.
Yes, but wait till you taste one, dearie. Like to try one? Go on. Go on. Have a bite.
And scene. I'm never accepting food from you again.
Scared myself.
That was creepy.
I gave myself chills.
That was creepy. And if I was Marilyn Monroe at all, crossed with Tootie, you were the Wicked Witch of the West, crossed with Yoda.
Good. That's what I was thinking. It came across.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Deadline is Monday, June 25th. And Josh, when you and Debbie come over this weekend, no gooseberry pie. It's not allowed. Don't bring it.
All right. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
If the film is by Wes Anderson, then it will make his list. Or from Pixar or Disney, well, you get the gist. But heavy-handed messages really aren't his thing. Time for Larson Recommends on Film Spotting.
The Larson Recommends theme. Haven't been able to bust that out in a while. We're only going to play it once, despite the fact that we have actually three movies to touch on. You've been a busy boy.
Yes.
You got to a lot of movies last weekend.
My bedtime has been extended
for
the summer.
I hope you brought the kids to Hereditary with you.
Well, so, I didn't go that far. I did take them to Ocean's 8.
Okay. There are three movies we're going to touch on. And judging from your Letterboxd comments, one you're going to highly recommend.
Yes.
One you're just kind of mildly going to recommend. And one you're just almost there, but not quite.
I don't know if I can do it.
Hereditary, Ocean's 8, Thoroughbreds. Which one's up first? Which one do you highly recommend?
So you got to see Hereditary. I think you even have to see it.
Do
yes,
I?
Because
who's going to hold my hand?
Well, it's not going to be me, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. It's a slow burn psychological horror film for much of its running time. Yes, it's creepy. Yes, it gets to a lot of scares. Speaking of gasps, mine wasn't quite as high pitched as yours in Massacre Theater, but I did let out a loud gasp about halfway through. This is really good, and it's mostly about grief, and it gives grief a demonic presence. Toni Collette plays a mother of a high schooler and a middle schooler. She's married to Gabriel Byrne. She creates these miniatures. She's an artist, so these dioramas, and her elderly mother has died as the movie opens, happened to be in her home. She was caring for her in her last days before her death. There's some weird things about her mother, and those set in motion a mystery that I won't reveal anything more about, but the grief that Collette's character feels, there's also kind of regret because of their relationship, blame and anger, and it really captures how all of those things can swirl together and mess with your head. First-time filmmaker, we thought maybe early on this year Hereditary might be a Golden Brick candidate because Ari Aster had not made a film before, but it's already made too much money.
Not a feature film.
Not a feature film. It's already made too much money for that. But he does some very inventive stuff with the camera, including making use of that miniature motif where there are certain scenes in this house they all live in where you're not quite sure, is he shooting a miniature now? Because she does, the Collette character does recreate her own rooms in her artwork. Hmm. And so that just throws you off and creates this sense of like someone is toying with this family. There's a sinister outside force that's treating them like dolls.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, and people are split on this, it gets more literal at the end. And instead of just letting monsters percolate mysteriously, psychologically, we see them. For me, I've just kind of, as I've seen more horror movies, I like to live in the mystery. I find that scarier. I find that creepier. This gets very literal in the end. And so some of the power of it is drained out for me. But for people who really like that stuff, they'd probably appreciate that a little bit more. But overall, Collette's great also.
Yeah.
Let me throw that out there. Like in the front runner for a performance of the year.
Really?
She's just captures all of those. It's really rooted in actual emotion and experience, but man, she also goes for it when things get nutty, and that's kind of fun too. So she's great. She's fantastic.
So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Didn't another recent horror movie that we both appreciated very much, The Babadook, put a demonic presence on grief?
Yes.
How is this different?
I thought about The Babadook a lot, and I think The Babadook does a better job of, even though there's a literal monster in it, who we see glimpses of, it balances that line of what's in her head and what isn't and keeps that fuzzier, I would say, than Hereditary does eventually in the end. I mean, I haven't revisited The Babadook, and I quite frankly can't tell you exactly what happens at the end.
Yeah.
But that's my memory of my experience of it, is it was a psychological mind twister more than this becomes. Both really good films, though. So, yeah, I hope you catch up with it.
Okay. Ocean's 8, literally a movie about someone with the last name Ocean, and there's 8 of them.
That's right. You've got it.
That's my provocative setup. Yeah. And I don't think it probably needs more than that.
No. You know, this is fun. It was fun enough. As I mentioned, saw it with the kids and, you know, I think I mentioned on an earlier show how a teenager said when she came out of another movie and saw the posters, like, I just wish they'd give these women their own movie rather than putting them in a movie that previously featured men. You know, the Ghostbusters thing. And I think that really does come into play here because if you just saw this on its own with no memory of Ocean's 11, you'd probably appreciate it a lot more. So that's working against it. Really, this is bringing together all of the same elements, except they're women, and doing a pretty good imitation, but you can always sense that the amount of fizz that the first Ocean's 11 had is just not there. Of course, Soderbergh isn't behind the camera. Mm-hmm. Gary Ross does try to mimic a lot of the formal jazziness that Soderbergh brought to it. I think that Bullock, that Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett manage some really good chemistry in their scenes together. The writing isn't quite as crisp, doesn't give them quite as much to work with. And there are fun scenes. The plot, there's a clockwork plot here, and it involves the Met and a fashion gala, and there's something fun about that. So I enjoyed it, but especially when you're thinking about them trying to be Ocean's 11, it just doesn't make that work.
Okay. The last film.
Thoroughbreds.
Thoroughbreds. Movie that many listeners have written in and said, we have to see it. A potential Golden Brick candidate. It seems as if you are probably willing to go along with it, though it may not make your top five finalists for the Golden Brick.
Yeah, I think it deserves consideration. I definitely want you to see it and more listeners as well to consider it in that category. Another first-time director here, Corey Finley, writer and director, and also makes clever use of the camera, especially with a lot of sustained single takes. It's basically set in this affluent Connecticut community and follows two teen girls who were friends when they were younger. A violent incident occurred that separated them, and at the start of the movie, they're sort of cautiously reuniting around that. One of them is played by Anya Taylor-Joy from The Witch, and the other is played by Olivia Cook. The Olivia Cook character is she basically states, I can't feel joy or sadness. And the movie depicts her as sort of a teen sociopath. The Anya Taylor-Joy character is having trouble with her stepfather. So the tension in the film is like, how is their new friendship going to affect that? How crazy might things get? It's very Heavenly Creatures, the Peter Jackson film, his breakout film. But it's not as interested in the psychology. It doesn't have as much imagination as that film did. It's really just kind of giddy about its central conceit of what if a teen girl was a sociopath. And there's something kind of hollow about it to me at the end. I do know, as you said, a lot of listeners have been really thrilled by it. Some of the filmmaking is sharp. So, yeah, I hope people do check it out, make up their own mind. I've seen a couple other people have come around to it. Also on Letterboxd, I think Matt Singer actually recently saw it and said it left him a little cold too. So there's definitely something about it where I don't think it means to move people or say much or necessarily be all that thoughtful. So I'm not saying it fails in doing anything, but in not doing any of those things, it still kind of left me at a distance from it.
Well, while you were seeing all these movies and being so productive in serving our audience with your insights, I was at a park shelter in a small town in Iowa at a high school reunion. So who wins, Josh? Who wins? Tell me that.
No comment. How to choose between Woody and Buzz, Mike and Sully, Joy and Sadness. That was the challenge with this week's Film Spotting Top 5 Pixar Performances. Our picks are up next. Stay with us.
God is not a contract or a guy. God is in a specified tie. You cannot time its tables. It sets no glass or gables. God is a lusty tire fire. Its bristles scrape and strike the stage. Rock, paper, scissors, rage at mercy on the natural world. My voice is not the liquid waves. The perfect ring.
In many ways, the work of a critic is easy. We risk very little, yet enjoy a position over those who offer up their work and themselves to our judgment. We thrive on negative criticism, which is fun to write and to read. But the bitter truth we critics must face is that in the grand scheme of things, the average piece of junk is probably more meaningful than our criticism designating it so. But there are times when a critic truly risks something, and that is in the discovery and defense of the new. The world is often unkind to new talent.
The great Peter O'Toole as Anton Ego in Pixar's Ratatouille. We might just hear more from Mr. O'Toole and Anton Ego as we get into our top five Pixar performances. But first, we need to wrap up a little bit of poll business. We asked you a few weeks ago here on the show which Pixar film from the 2000s should be the highest seed in next year's Film Spotting Madness. Just a little bit of background if you haven't been following the show recently. We've done 3 years of Film Spotting Madness, bracket of 64, and it all comes down to one winner. We've done actors and actresses. We've done directors. We've done the Film Spotting Pantheon. And our plan after doing this past one. So we've had four. We did the best of the 90s most recently. Next March and April, we are going to do the best of the 2000s. We thought we'd get a little bit of the work done ahead of time. We'd let you help us out. Which Pixar movie should be the highest seed? Because there are several good films to choose from. And I think right now, at least four that figure to be in the final bracket. So in chronological order, your options were Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, or Up. How did it come out, Josh?
Probably not a surprise that Cars is in last place. It says here it got 1% of the vote, but
now this is a surprise.
Sam left a note, actually less than 1%, two probably accidental votes.
Two
total
votes
out of more than 600.
I have to know. The two people who voted for Cars, you have to show yourselves. Email the show. feedback@filmspotting.net.
If they
make your case.
If they can prove it, do they get a t-shirt?
Tell us that it wasn't an accident.
All right. Shaming listeners. I love it. Next up in the poll was Monsters, Inc. with 6%. Up received 13%. Look at this run. 13% for Up, 14% for Finding Nemo, 15% for Ratatouille. Then a little bit of jump here. 19% of the vote went to The Incredibles, but the winner was WALL-E with 32% of the vote.
Paul Castle in Seattle says, I've been an unabashed glutton of all things Pixar since I first saw Toy Story in the movie theater at 10 years old. My 23-year-old love affair with the Pixar compendium makes this a challenging decision, but upon rewatching all of these films over the past year, I concluded that there is only one right answer, Up. Let me make this easy to understand. Every other film listed in this poll sounds like a fantastic idea on paper. Monsters, robots, talking cars, a rat with big dreams, a fish on a thrilling journey, and a family of superheroes. Sure, they're all wonderfully original, but when you hear them pitched, isn't it easy to imagine how fun they will be? Now take Up. A senior citizen travels to Venezuela while grieving and ultimately accepting his wife's tragic death. Just think about that for a second. And yet, with the odds stacked against it, the movie winds up being the most inventive, most inspired, and most emotionally cathartic animated film I've ever seen. And yes, Adam, I've seen Grave of the Fireflies. If you haven't seen Up in a while, watch it again, and you will agree. There's a reason the Academy recognized it as the sole Best Picture nominee among those seven films. Sam Van Halgren note, Up, Toy Story 3, and Beauty and the Beast, the only animated features nominated for the Best Picture Oscar, all before the creation of the Best Animated Film category.
That is a strong case, Paul. We also heard from Jeff Paretsky, so torn on this one, WALL-E or Up? I finally chose WALL-E because of the first half. I love the second half, but the silent movie vibe of WALL-E living on Earth all alone except for his companion and the courting of Eve is wonderful. With that said, I will fight to the end of my days that the first act slash reel of Up is one of the best love stories ever put on film. If you are as evil here as you have been in the past, you will rig the Film Spotting Madness bracket so that WALL-E and Up go against each other near the end.
Don't give us any ideas. It might just happen. WALL-E then will be the number one seed in Film Spotting Madness 2019 Best of the 2000s, and that is actually the way Sam and I had it lining up so far. So, validation there. We do currently have Nemo, The Incredibles, WALL-E, and Ratatouille making the cut. Up is right now on the outside looking in.
Don't tell Paul. Do not tell Paul.
We are going to get some hate mail, and we have some time to reconsider that one. Let's go ahead, Josh, and get to our top five Pixar performances, focusing on the voice, which I suppose one could say What other options do you have? Of course, they're vocal performances, but tell us how you approach this list.
I'm excited we're doing this because I've long been a proponent of honoring vocal performances when it comes to awards time, you know, in the acting categories. And so this is a chance to really drill down into what makes this sort of acting so impressive. I think probably there's a misperception that it's easier in a way because, well, you just got to use your voice, right? But if you think about it, the reverse is probably true. You're asking someone to give a performance using only one tool
right
in their toolbox.
Yeah, the physicality is immediately taken out of it.
Gone.
And you're not acting against the other voice.
You don't have people to respond to in front of you. Yeah, you're creating it all there in the studio. So we wanted to recognize those sorts of performances. And I also think it's perfect to do this for a Pixar film because both the casting and the performance themselves have been such a crucial part of the Pixar formula. I really think as much as the animation itself, what makes the best of Pixar so special is the way they match the right actor, not just big name star,
yes,
but the right actor with the right role, and then give them the material they need to give a full performance. So to that end, you know, a lot of funny bit parts I could have gone with for this list. I probably will mention a few of those in our honorable mentions, but I did choose five that I think could rightly stand in an Oscar nominee list because they do give such full-bodied performances.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good approach. Let's hear your number five.
Okay, at number five, I'm going with Sadness, voiced by Phyllis Smith in Inside Out. I think this is a great example of Pixar going with relatively obscure casting. Smith is probably best known as Phyllis from NBC's The Office, but she was the perfect choice for the voice of one of the main emotions inside young Riley's head in 2015's Inside Out.
Wait, Joy, you could get lost in there.
Think positive.
Okay. I'm positive you will get lost in there. That's long-term memory, an endless warren of corridors and shelves. I read about it in the manuals.
The manuals? The manuals! You read the manuals!
Yeah.
So you know the way back to headquarters.
I guess.
I've described Sadness as a blue bespectacled blob whose sentences trail off at the end like faint echoes that persist in spite of themselves. And that speaks to the physicality that Smith brings to her voice performance. Her voice doesn't just have a sound, but it also has a weight to it. You get the sense that Sadness's voice would be heavy to hold in your hands. We heard from lots of listeners on social media for this list, including Cole Bauer. He shared this on Twitter about Smith's performance. Some emotions seem easier to pull off. Anger, just scream. Joy, laugh. But to voice sadness and loneliness and make these extremely personal and internal emotions relatable, that takes the right person with great talent. I think, you know, there's more to probably voicing anger and joy than that, too. Those are great performances in Inside Out as well by Lewis Black and Amy Poehler. But yeah, Phyllis Smith, perfect person, turns out, for Sadness.
Yeah, she really is wonderful. I didn't regularly watch The Office, but my sense of watching clips earlier today from Inside Out, including clips that featured Sadness, is that Phyllis Smith is, to an extent, putting on a voice to play Sadness. That isn't how she normally sounds. And of course,
yeah, I think that's fair.
All of these performers, on some level, are putting on a voice. But actually, in looking at my list, I picked five who are kind of playing versions of themselves.
Okay.
I think you might argue. They're not pretending to be someone else. It's not a super heightened version of their voice. It feels pretty natural.
But there's a difference, I think, and we'll see when we get to your
picks. And I don't know if that's the right approach.
Well, I guess
who should you be recognizing? You know, the person who's doing more of a performance than someone who's trading on the essence of their character and
their
persona.
I think the mistake a lot of animated films make is that they want you to know from the first word that, oh, that's Will Smith.
Yeah.
And I want him to be Will Smith.
And that's,
but my guess is your picks are, yes, they're not doing a quote-unquote character, but giving, again, like a full performance.
100%. And that is a perfect segue into my number five and a voicemail, because I actually share my number five with a longtime Film Spotting listener who knows a thing or two about not only animation, but about Pixar. His name's Rob Denovan. He's an animator at Pixar. And I reached out to him and said, if you could think of one performance that stacks up as your favorite from any Pixar movie, what would it be? And here it is.
Hi, Adam and Josh. This is Rob Denovan calling in from Pixar Animation with my pick for the top performance in a Pixar film. One of the greatest strengths, I think, of the studio here is their ability to cast voice actors that are immediately familiar yet unrecognizable to the audience. One of the traps animation studios sometimes fall into is hiring this clearly identifiable voice that can overshadow the animation performance and distract the audience from the film. So using a voice actor that complements the animation is really key. My pick has to be Jason Lee as Syndrome from The Incredibles. As someone who grew up skateboarding in the 90s, I have to admit that I have a strong bias towards Jason Lee, but his performance worked on so many levels. Syndrome as a character needed to be humorous and ridiculous, but at the same time menacing and a genuine risk to Bob and his family. Swing too far to the comedic side and the audience won't buy that he's a genuine threat. But you swing too far into the pure evil and you lose the awkwardness and comedy of this character who's essentially just a bullied kid seeking revenge. Jason Lee managed to pull this off in this performance that's both hilarious and genuinely unnerving.
I only wanted to help, and what did you say to me?
Fly home, buddy. I work alone.
It tore me apart, but I learned an important lesson. You can't count on anyone, especially your heroes.
I was wrong to treat you that way. I'm sorry.
See? Now you respect me, because I'm a threat. That's the way it works. Turns out there are a lot of people, whole countries, who want respect, and they will pay through the nose to get it.
As an honorable mention and fun side note, I'd also like to pick fellow animator Brett Parker as the voice of the babysitter in the first Incredibles. Rumor has it that she initially recorded the scratch dialogue for the storyboards, and they liked it so much that they kept her.
Bob, listen to this.
Anyway, so there you have it. Those are my two votes. Keep up the good work. Love the show, guys. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Rob, so much for taking the time to leave that voicemail and for all the great work you've done over the years. He nailed it, right? Not only with his pick, but what you were saying, Josh, in terms of sometimes studios can pick voices that are recognizable and as a result can kind of be distracting. And there's the flip side of that where I can watch something like Incredibles 2 and for a good chunk of that running time, I'm going, man, I recognize the voice that Catherine Keener ultimately is the person who plays her. But that's good. I think I would rather have that than be constantly aware of who the performer is. I love the match of voice to character, and somehow Pixar just seems to tap into, I think I used this word already, but the essence of someone, not just one or two adjectives you might use to describe that person in other movies or what their voice conjures for you, but something essential to their being. And I'm going to try to get at that, I guess, with my picks. And we'll start with my number five. It is Syndrome, Rob's number one. Just like Mr. Incredible in that movie, I think we have a tendency as viewers, we want to dismiss him as a character, Buddy, who later becomes Syndrome, because there's an eagerness to Jason Lee's voice, this overzealousness that just makes him someone that we kind of want to go away and quit bugging us. But that only heightens his heel turn when we do see the threat that he becomes, because we believe that that constant dismissal, being this character who for his entire life has not been taken seriously, we believe that that would push him far enough to make him this deranged villain that he becomes. And there is something about Jason Lee's voice that is just so naturally cajoling. And it's funny coming off of a rewatch of Almost Famous and talking about that, because what defines Jason Lee's performance as Jeff Beebe? He wants to be taken seriously as the lead singer of Stillwater so badly that he pushes and pushes and pushes, only to have the one person whose approval he craves, Russell Hammond, and here as Syndrome, Mr. Incredible, reject him. And Rob really just gets it right when he says that he manages to balance Lee with his performance, manages to balance the comedy that we need in order to laugh at that character, but that bit of menace that we need in order to see him as someone who can actually bring down this family, which is what we care about the most.
I think Lee seems to be able to hit that register of neediness in both of those performances that, it fits for both films too. I'm going to stick with the villain theme here for my number four pick, because I have Lotso Huggenbear, voiced by Ned Beatty in Toy Story 3. Yes, the evil bear who smells of strawberries, given a genial drawl with an undercurrent of menace by Beatty. Even during Lotso's warm welcome early on of Andy's toys to the daycare center that's really at the center of the movie, you can tell that something is off.
How long has it been since you all got played with?
It's been years.
Well, just you wait. In a few minutes, that bell's gonna ring and you'll get the playtime that you've been dreaming of.
Play! Real play! I can't wait!
Now, if you'll excuse us, we'd best be heading back. Welcome to Sunnyside, folks.
Thank you!
Take care, Pinky!
Bye, Mr. Lotso. Thank you.
Of course, Lotso goes on to become a fantastic villain along the level of Syndrome. He's got a rich backstory as well. We get to see it all in flashback. He has understandable motivation for his villainy, and he is also a real threat. And when that threat is revealed and Lotso's lies are exposed, the brilliance of Beatty's performance is the way he then flips the formula. So if at first his voice had two parts charm to one part intimidation, you can kind of slightly detect. Here, Lotso is mostly threatening, but he still has a little bit of folksiness to go with
it. Oh, yeah.
Don't do this, Lotso!
She's a Barbie doll, Ken. There's 100 million just like her.
Not to me, there's not.
Fine. Then why don't you join her?
Lotso Huggenbear, my number four.
That is a great choice, and I didn't really think about it, but I've got another villain of sorts at number four, and we've already heard the voice, Peter O'Toole, as Anton Ego, the critic, in Ratatouille. I say a villain of sorts because the reality is he provides the emotional catharsis of the film. And despite his appearance, he's this tall, lanky, imposing figure. He's dressed in black. He's got those black eyes. When they show that overhead shot of his office, it's actually shaped like a coffin.
Yeah.
So there's this real Nosferatu aspect
yes.
to Anton Ego. But rewatching scenes today, I was struck by how charming he is, even before his transformation at the very end of the film. Even when he's being a self-centered jerk, which he is all the time, there is a charm to him and even a sense, enough of a sense of his love of life, his love of pleasure, that you understand when he says, even though he's actually being a condescending jerk in the moment, when he says, I don't like food, I love food, and if I don't, I don't swallow it. There's enough of that humor and almost warmth to O'Toole and his performance that you believe that if he has become a more dark, cynical version of the critic he began as, we at least know it was in him at one point, and there might still be some remnants of it there. And of course, Peter O'Toole has always been this charming, larger-than-life figure, someone who, as an actor, you just love listening to him in tone words. That's really what makes this character, Anton Ego, the gravitas isn't in his appearance or how intimidating he is. It's in the way he uses words. And O'Toole has that voice that can go so very deep and be so rhythmic. Pardon the puns here, Josh, but he doesn't chew each line so much as subtly swill them.
I haven't reviewed Gusto in years.
No, sir.
My last review condemned it to the tourist trade.
Yes, sir.
I said, Gusto has finally found his rightful place in history right alongside another equally famous chef, Monsieur Boyardee.
Touché.
That is where I left it. That was my last word. The last word.
Yes.
Then tell me, Ambrister, how could it be popular?
I love it. I wish he was in the movie more than he is. I mentioned that catharsis, the epiphany moment that happens at the end of the movie. Maybe it's because I had been watching scenes from Inside Out, thinking about another pick, but I was thinking about how food, while not one of the five senses, of course, it can prompt all of them. Food can make you feel joy and disgust and anger and sadness and fear, too. You can be afraid of those things that you don't quite understand or are unsure of. There's just something primal that the movie captures and O'Toole captures that the smell or just a slight taste of food can elicit. And if you pay attention to O'Toole's performance post-epiphany, when he has that speech at the end, his voice is actually different. He sounds less like this orator. And he sounds more like a person, less like a character. He was maybe playing a bit of a role before. He had to fit a certain part, this creation that was Anton Ego. And now he's himself. He's more vulnerable. You hear it in O'Toole's voice. And let's face it, those words we heard, his words about the role of the critic and the defense of the new being the great risk that a critic can take. That's exactly right. I don't think anybody's gotten more right what it means to be a critic, the folly of it and the function of it, better than Brad Bird and company do in Ratatouille.
Yeah, that moment is probably a contender for a top five Pixar moments list. And O'Toole is an honorable mention for me for this list, too, because he is so strong in Ratatouille. All right, at number three, I'm going with a character we've already spent some time talking about from The Incredibles. It's Holly Hunter's Elastigirl. And as you could probably tell from our review, I'm already wondering, should I have swapped that with Craig T. Nelson's Mr. Incredible? But the catch is that they work so well together, right?
Yes.
It's their scenes together that are the strongest. Hunter, you know, she's always had a really distinctive voice. Sometimes it's even used as a bit of caricature, maybe in Raising Arizona, where she's very funny. She's doing a little bit of that. But I think what's notable about her performance as Elastigirl, aka wife and mother Helen Parr, is how down-to-earth her delivery is. So she's really grounding the movie's concerns in the everyday, in the relatable. And on that recent revisit I did of The Incredibles before seeing Incredibles 2, it really was the willingness to confront domestic trauma that surprised me about the movie that I'd kind of forgotten about, especially when it comes to that relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Incredible. It's that late night scene we referenced in our review that I really love in The Incredibles.
It was coming down anyway.
Tell me you haven't been listening to the police scanner again.
Look, I performed a public service. You act like that's a bad thing.
It is a bad thing, Bob. Uprooting our family again so you can relive the glory days is a very bad thing.
Reliving the glory days is better than acting like they didn't happen.
Yes, they happened. But this, our family, is what's happening now, Bob. And you are missing this. I can't believe you don't want to go to your own son's graduation.
It's not a graduation. He is moving from the fourth grade to the fifth grade.
It's a ceremony.
It's psychotic. They keep creating new ways to celebrate mediocrity, but if someone is genuinely exceptional,
then
this
is not about you, Bob. This is about Dash.
You want to do something for Dash? Then let him actually compete. Let him go out for sports.
I will not be made the enemy here. You know why we can't do that.
Because it'd be great!
This is not about you!
So I have Elastigirl at number three, but for listener Ryan McQuaid, he chimed in on Twitter. He's got her even higher. He wrote, Holly Hunter in The Incredibles is the holy grail of Pixar voice performances. This is one of the first times I ever felt true emotions and empathy for a Pixar character. Plus, she is such a badass hero, wife, and mother. Ryan's right on all three counts. I do love how Hunter brings those three different sides of Helen Parr into one consistent vocal performance. So Elastigirl is my number three.
Great, great choice. Definitely an honorable mention for me. My number three is Joan Cusack as Jessie from Toy Story 2 and 3.
Look, Jessie, I know you hate me for leaving, but I have to go back. I'm still Andy's toy. Well, if you knew him, you'd understand. You see, Andy's
Let me guess. Andy's a real special kid. And to him, you're his buddy, his best friend. And when Andy plays with you, it's like, even though you're not moving, you feel like you're alive. Because that's how he sees you.
How did you know that?
Because Emily was just the same. She was my whole world.
When somebody loved me, everything was beautiful.
In fairness, it is Sarah McLachlan's voice and that animated sequence that really devastates us when we see the backstory on Jessie, When She Loved Me. But everything about Cusack's performance and the depth she gives Jessie is really what stands out to me the most when I think about Toy Story 2. And it goes back to what Rob said about Pixar finding ways to cast familiar yet unrecognizable voices. Most of the time, I think Joan Cusack would fit that bill. A lot of people know that voice. They're sure of it, but may not be able to pick her out. And there has just always been a gumption to Joan Cusack characters. I think if you look up Rootin' Tootin' in the dictionary, you would see a picture of Joan Cusack. But as with all these Pixar characters, so many of them that are on our lists and you can see throughout these movies, there are more dimensions to Jessie. Cusack, she brings the energy and that cowgirl spirit that Jessie needs, but she also really nails the fear and desperation that belies that spirit. And we got a comment from Leo Cohn on Twitter who said that his top two non-Woody and Buzz Pixar characters would be Sarah Bowell as Violet from Incredibles, but also Jessie, the cowgirl Joan Cusack. Cusack delivers an enthusiasm that masks past trauma. I also love how when she gets into a fight with Woody, you're sure Woody is going to come out of it on the wrong end. There's just that much grit to Cusack's performance.
You calling me a liar?
Well, if the boot fits.
Say that again.
If the boot fits.
Okay, cowboy. Yeah!
So I was just watching a Cusack clip from Broadcast News because we were considering it for Massacre Theater. Didn't end up doing it. But yeah, your description of her is right on. And
it's there in that scene.
Yeah.
The determination, the tape scene to get it to air, and her over-eagerness, that spirit, it's in a lot of her performances.
Yeah, that's a good pick. All right, at number two, I have Dory, Ellen DeGeneres from Finding Nemo. This one's a character and a performance beloved and memorable enough to earn her own movie, Finding Dory. But I'm singling her out for her work in 2003's Finding Nemo. I think it's our shared number one Pixar film, Adam. Yep. That's where we have things ranked right now, at least. This is, I think, also my first pure comedian on the list. But what I like about this part is it's an example of how Pixar usually doesn't just cast comedians in the parts with punchlines. Like, you're the funny person, you're going to do the funny lines. Instead, they give them a chance to do some of that, but also play more well-rounded characters. I don't know, I guess we wouldn't consider Jason Lee a comedian per se, but you could see how he might be cast to do just that sort of thing. But instead, Syndrome, as you described, gets so much more to do. Even with Dory, though, who's really built around the conceit of short-term memory loss, it isn't only the comic situation or the funny dialogue or her speaking whale that makes Dory memorable. Instead, it's the notes of melancholy. It's really melancholy naivete that DeGeneres brings to the performance.
Stop following me, okay?
What are you talking about? You're showing me which way the boat went.
A boat? Hey, I've seen a boat. It passed by not too long ago. It went this way. It went this way. Follow me.
Wait a minute. What is going on? You already told me which way the boat was going.
I did? Oh, no.
If this is some kind of practical joke, it's not funny. And I know funny. I'm a clownfish.
No, it's not. I know it's not. I'm so sorry. See, I suffer from short-term memory loss.
Short-term memory loss? I don't believe this.
No, it's true. I forget things almost instantly. It runs in my family. Well, I mean, at least I think it does.
So yeah, Dory could have just been a punchline, but thanks to the writers, thanks to DeGeneres' performance, Finding Nemo, I think of as much as being Dory's adventure as anyone else's, really.
Well, we are in agreement on the strength of that performance, though I have a different character and vocal performance from Finding Nemo at number two, Albert Brooks as Marlin. Inside Out is this movie about childhood, mostly from the child's point of view. Nemo is childhood from the parents' point of view, for the most part. Yes, of course, we get both. We do spend a lot of time with Nemo and his efforts to get back to his dad, but this really is Marlin's movie. And Scott Tobias, our friend from the Next Picture Show, has written a lot about Albert Brooks over the years, and he did a primer for the AV Club on Brooks with Nathan Rabin a few years back, and he wrote this: Brooks' talents as a voice artist were already plain in The Simpsons, but as a clownfish searching for his missing son in Pixar's Finding Nemo, he's able to exhibit the range of his abilities as a comedian and a dramatic actor. Being a clownfish, Brooks's Marlin is expected by the other sea creatures to be a funny guy, and he tries his best to accommodate them, even though he doesn't know any good jokes and his comic timing would be too stilted to deliver them anyway. When Marlin tries to entertain, the result is a calamity that plays like Brooks's early years as a stand-up deconstructionist, producing comedy by utterly dismantling hacky gags. Yet Finding Nemo requires emotional beats too, and Marlin's pleas for his son in the open waters are, in Brooks's cadence, piercing and true. I mean, really, who better to play a clownfish, if you were just throwing that out there, than Albert Brooks? And yet you can't just focus on the neuroses, that aspect to Brooks and his persona. Could Woody Allen, could Richard Lewis, could Larry David have done a better job with Marlin than Albert Brooks? Could they have played Marlin and brought any sense of that warmth that he brings, or made those emotional beats that are so crucial to this movie feel as authentic? I'm going to say no chance. And I would also say that I don't think Brooks's persona has ever really been just about that personal neediness. That isn't always what defined him. It's something more universal for me anyway. It's this quest his character always seems to be on for equilibrium, for balance of some kind, searching for something authentic, something that's true and real, and maybe hoping that that's going to add up somehow to happiness. And that's what he has with Nemo. And that's why he needs Nemo back so desperately. So just perfect casting of Albert Brooks as Marlin by Pixar.
How's the lucky fin?
Lucky.
Let's see. Are you sure you want to go to school this year? Because there's no problem if you don't. You can wait 5 or 6 years.
Come on, Dad. It's time for school.
Forgot to brush.
Oh.
Do you want this anemone to sting you?
Yes.
Brush.
Okay, I'm done.
Up, you missed a spot.
Where?
There.
Sounds like Finding Nemo should maybe go in the Pantheon.
Should it?
I think it should.
We've talked about it a lot over the years. It is our shared number one Pixar movie, kind of inexplicably, that we both have it there.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
Okay, let's do it. Sam, do the honors. Finding Nemo to the Pantheon.
I'll be right here.
Bye, Elmo!
Nemo.
Nemo! Bye, Nemo!
See you at the school, Dory! Bye, Nemo!
Bye, Sam.
All right, we are at number one, and in that slot, I have Bing Bong, Richard Kind from Inside Out. I'm bookending my list with another Inside Out pick. This is one which Ben Schultz on my Facebook page even described as Oscar-worthy, and I agree. Bing Bong is the imaginary friend of little Riley who fades away as Riley grows older and forgets him. Now, Richard Kind has a very distinct, some might even say aggravating voice, but it is perfect for this manic imaginary character. Kind, especially when we first meet Bing Bong, sort of plays him like an aggressive vaudeville act. But he also tempers that performance at really crucial moments and brings in this bittersweet register. And then his quavering voice, it begins to recognize, you get the sense he's recognizing that it's only a matter of time before he's gone for good. Bing Bong is kind of in a way a little bit like Dory and Sadness rolled into one character, especially when you trace their arcs. And that's part of the reason I have him this high on my list. I think this wistful touch is especially heard in the moment when Bing Bong watches his beloved rocket wagon get pushed into the memory dump. So he knows this means Riley is forgetting him. He sits down in desolation and he's consoled by Sadness to bring things full circle on my list.
I'm sorry they took your rocket. They took something that you loved. It's gone. Forever.
Sadness. Don't make him feel worse.
Sorry.
It's all I had left of Riley.
I bet you and Riley had great adventures.
Oh, they were wonderful. Once we flew back in time, we had breakfast twice that day.
Sadness!
It sounds amazing. I bet Riley liked it.
Oh, she did. We were best friends.
At our live rap party for 2015, I named this scene as my most moving moment. So even though Oscar has yet to recognize a Pixar voice performance, I've at least given Phyllis Smith and Richard Kind that honor. And Kind himself, he gets my number one slot, my favorite Pixar performance.
Yeah, that is a great choice. And I'm going to try to balance things out here, Albert Brooks style a little bit. All this sadness, not only having sadness on your list, but then the sad character that is Bing Bong with joy. Amy Poehler as my number one Pixar performance from Inside Out. We heard from Jer on Twitter, who says lots of possible answers, but the one that keeps fighting her way to the top of my list is Amy Poehler, a fierce, demanding performance that runs the emotional gamut. Her tearful speech at the bottom of the pit wrecks me harder than anything else in Pixar's oeuvre.
Do you remember how she used to stick her tongue out when she was coloring? I could listen to her stories all day.
Again, they just got it so right. They tapped into one of her defining traits. If you've seen Poehler on SNL or on Parks and Rec or any other performance, besides being gifted when it comes to comedic timing, she is naturally a bit zany. There's a sprightly aspect to her, and she is all that with joy, but she's never overbearing or manic. She doesn't take up the volume or even the tempo, really, of her normal speech. She heightens it just a little bit, mainly, in a lot of scenes, by disregarding punctuation. She just runs a lot of words together. Her performance doesn't suggest that there is a performance aspect to joy. I think she is precisely the identity trait, the emotion that she is supposed to embody, but the performance does actually reinforce a dominant theme in the movie, in that as much as she's supposedly in charge, and as much as we want to believe joy is our default state, she does just have to work a little bit harder. than all the other emotions. We see that she's the first emotion that Riley ever experiences when she's born, but then that emotion is immediately supplanted by all the others. Joy is putting out the fires throughout the whole movie caused by all the other emotions. Maybe I just kind of relate to the control freak aspect of Joy, Josh, but her journey, her transformation really is inside out.
No,
don't obsess over the weight of life's problems. Remember the funny movie where the dog dies?
Oh, sadness, we don't have time for this. We'll just have to go around. Take the scenic route.
Wait, Joy, you could get lost in there.
Think positive.
Okay, I'm positive you will get lost in there.
And that's another great example of someone thought of primarily as a comedian getting a chance to play a character
yes.
that has, I mean, in some instances, these are the richest or maybe most all-encompassing roles some of these
right.
actors have been given because
yeah.
other filmmakers don't trust them with, you know, a more dramatic part.
That's it.
But with Pixar, they get the shot at
yeah.
it.
Yeah, like Scott said about Albert Brooks in Finding Nemo, she gets to hit emotional beats that I can't think of any other performance of hers where she has been given that opportunity. So we thank Pixar and we thank Amy Poehler for that. Those are our top five Pixar performances. I know there are so many we could honorably mention. I'm not sure it's even worth it.
Well,
we're going to scratch the surface.
Yeah, I just want to give another nod to Sarah Vowell as Violet Parr, especially in Incredibles 2. If I had seen that before making this list, she might have squeaked on here. Patton Oswalt is also fits right in with your Amy Poehler pick, right? A comedian who, look at what he gets a chance to do and pulls off in Ratatouille as Remy. And then I do want to mention that I have sort of a special director cameo category. So Brad Bird as Edna
yes.
Mode, he reprises that part in Incredibles 2. Also Andrew Stanton as Crush. And my favorite of all of these, I tried to research and find out for sure who these voices were and found the suggestion. It seems to also be Stanton as one of the Flock of Seagulls.
Yeah.
Does that sound right
to you? I think I saw that too.
Mine. That bit, I laugh out loud at no matter how many times I watched Finding Nemo.
Well, beyond some of the ones you mentioned, I do have to go back and say this is the Reach for the Sky memorial list, because I don't know how you talk about Pixar performances and not give love to Tom Hanks as Sheriff Woody, not only because it's a great, great performance, but it's also the performance that, in a lot of ways, launched this whole effort, what we're discussing here, because without Woody and Toy Story, we don't have the Pixar empire.
Yeah,
perhaps.
That's a good way to put it, because, of course, the performance is great, but also to have someone of that stature do that, I wonder how much that legitimized these sorts of performances, not only for actors considering that these are rich roles, but also for Pixar to say, hey, we've got to resource this as well as we resource the more technological
yeah.
elements of our productions.
I do really love Tim Allen as Buzz Lightyear as well. John Goodman and Billy Crystal as Sully and Mike Wazowski in the Monsters, Inc. movies. We touched on this in our review of Incredibles 2. For me, the one that I would probably redo if I had seen Incredibles 2 before forming this list instead of after is Huck Milner as Dash Parr. I said it. Probably my favorite character in the Incredibles movies, and those movies are filled with wonderful characters. There really are so many more we can mention. The last name I want to throw out, even though I don't have one performance to pinpoint, but you can't talk about Pixar performances and not talk about John Ratzenberger.
Underminer.
The Underminer. He is the only actor, or one of them, one of a few. He might be the only one.
Yeah, I think he's the only one that's
who
been
has
in every
appeared in
production.
Every Pixar movie. He has voiced a character, however big or small, at least one in every Pixar movie.
And always more enjoyable
he's great.
Than every Stan Lee cameo.
You're not wrong there. Again, those are our top five Pixar performances. We'd love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
At filmspotting.net, you can find 13 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. That includes The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find them in Apple Podcasts or through your preferred podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, a film most likely to make me cry and therefore find a way onto my top 10 films of 2018, Hearts Beat Loud. Oh, yeah. A father and daughter form an unlikely songwriting duo in the summer before she leaves for college. It stars Nick Offerman. In wide release, Superfly. It opened this past Wednesday. It's a remake of the 1972 blaxploitation classic Tag, which is allegedly based on a true story about a group of former classmates who organize an elaborate annual game of tag that requires some to travel all over the country. Isla Fisher, John Hamm, Jeremy Renner, Ed Helms star in that. And Incredibles 2 is out, recommended by the both of us. Next week on the show, we will discuss Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And
deep breath there. You took a deep breath.
I have been fighting this so hard, but we're going to do it. And maybe it will all pay off when we get to share our top five movie Chris's.
Power rankings. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed the show, please do give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts so that we can reach some new listeners. Our music this week is by Nico Case, comes from her new album, Hell On. More information at NicoCase.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.